It's Friday, May 14th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, short love letters are appearing all over Los Angeles. Scrolling messages submitted by writers across LA are now featured on the facades of the city's libraries. We talked to the project's curator and two of its jurors. Then, tough questions, Suzanne Nossel responds to the week in free speech. We talk about the ongoing threats to protest rights, human rights in Iran, and efforts in Washington to revitalize local news. And we're going daily again. Next week, we'll be broadcasting every day as part of the Penn World Voices Festival. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Penn Pod. I am here to learn what books and birds know of flight. Right now, dozens of messages like that are currently scrolling across giant LED signs outside Los Angeles County libraries. It's part of Love Letters in Light, a project conceived by artist and curator Leila Hamidi. The project's jury includes LA-based poets selected with the support of Pen America Los Angeles and the library. Two of those jurors join me now, Jerry Quickly and Jessica Salgado, along with the project's curator, Leila Hamidi. Welcome to you all.
How you doing?
Hello, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, pleasure. Thanks for all of you for being here. Leila, let me just start with you. Tell us a little bit about the origins of this project and what you hope it's going to achieve.
Sure. The origin of the project comes from a county initiative through the LA Department of Mental Health. Called We Rise. It is an annual event or initiative that takes place each May for Mental Health Awareness Month. And I'm the co-director of one arm of that called Art Rise, which I won't get too much into. It's going to be temporary outdoor art installations. But as part of the effort, the county also wanted different county departments to collaborate using the tools of the arts as a way to create pathways towards collective well-being. And so I came up with this idea to literally put words on the surface of county buildings. Words are usually inside them, but not on top of them in that sense, but also as a way for us to make collective sense of the last year, the twin impacts of the pandemic and reckoning of racialized violence. And charged all the poets with saying more with less, literally and figuratively, 15 words, and asking them to address things that have real political undertones, but in a sense, not being overtly political because it's a public project and on a public building. And so, and then fun ensued.
That's amazing. And forgive me, you might hear some barking dogs in the background. So maybe, Jerry, we go to you next. You know, what brought you to this project as a juror?
Well, I've had a long connection with Leila, and when she first told me about it, I thought that the project held a lot of promise because this city, like many places throughout the country and globally, really kind of took it in the face with both barrels, particularly last year. And I wanted to find a way to center and hold some of the community's feelings and to validate them. And while also acknowledging some way through the work that there is a gross inequality that was taking place, but we are nonetheless here together and we can do better. And so the attempt was to write something that was meaningful for everyone, but still centered the political realities of walking across this, what was ultimately a deeply lethal landscape in the past 14 months or so.
Yeah. I mean, Jessica, did you have similar motivations, different things that brought you to this project?
Absolutely. I also think that one of the most important things for me with art and with painting is to make it accessible. And what's more accessible than a scrolling message on the side of a building that anybody could participate in. And so I felt that that was a really beautiful way to not only send love letters to our city, but also to share our artistry in a very unconventional but very, 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 again, accessible way.
Yeah, I mean, Leila, looping back to you, I mean, this idea of the words going across buildings. I mean, you said, normally with public spaces, the words are inside, not on the outside. I'm thinking a lot of like church architecture, or like turn of the century architecture, where you see, like a church, right, with a Latin phrase above the door or something like this. I mean, is there what is it about our public spaces? I mean, the words on the outside, the words on the inside, that inspires you?
Well, I think the thing about public space in general, I can't speak too much to churches because it's not my background, and somehow as a first generation, I managed to avoid that whole lineage. But I think the thing about public buildings, public space, is a reminder that it belongs to us, that it's part of the commons, and somehow reclaiming the commons might be some of the work that we need to do now. And also that there is openings that happen in our minds and our hearts when beauty takes place in an unexpected way. And so I think that public space can also do that. When something that is supposed to have only functional purpose, as a pun intended, poetic purpose, new things can happen in our imagination and so on.
Yeah, I mean, and just staying with you, Layla, for a minute. I mean, coming out of this period, or as we continue to churn through this period, what are your hopes for writers, artists, for what happens post-pandemic, both in LA and globally?
I really think that art, writing are all collective tools for sense making. We need to make sense of what has just happened. So, and they are also tools for deep imagination, and we need both of those to course correct. I think America's ready for a truth and reconciliation process, and the arts can be a good tool alongside that. And what I hope to see is artists and writers all lending their power and platforms towards abolition.
Jerry, if you want to pick up on that, I also wanted to ask you a bit about the messages that you feel like you would have liked to see or receive this time a year ago.
I think that the messages that were most resonant and relevant for me were the messages that focused not just on suffering or disruption and hardship, but rather those core human elements that bring us together, or that connect us through the evolution of these feelings. And it is that sense of personal internal evolution done, really in a sense, connected on a community stage, where through the eyes of one, you really feel and see the eyes of thousands. And I just wanted the work to be relevant. One of the meetings we had, I mentioned to the other writers that it was really critically important to me that I didn't write something that was not relevant and kind of meaningless. That if George Floyd or Breonna Taylor were standing in front of that library, I didn't want them to like write off the message. I wanted it to be relevant for our fallen, as well as those of us that are still here.
Jessica, I wonder that call to the call to relevance, the call to both those who are here and who are not here. I wonder how you view that, and then also for your views on how the city's civic spaces and how works like this influence your own work.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that I just want to sit with what Jerry said for a second, because I think that when we had that conversation collectively, as a jury and also writers contributing this beautiful project, it really affected me in a sense where there's so many things that happen within our city, right? That folks might be receiving these messages in moments that we don't even know. Right, we have a huge houseless crisis happening in our city, and displacement of encampments and all these things. And I'm thinking of these same folks that are some of our marginalized, most of our marginalized neighbors, right? But they get to experience this art in the same way that we do. So like somebody that's houseless, somebody that's taking the bus on the way home, or that's walking down the street and isn't expecting to see this beautiful message in light, gets to experience it in a way. And that's kind of how I was introduced to literature. I didn't do the college route. I didn't even finish high school, but I always had libraries. I always read anything that I came across in the city. I remember reading poems inside of buses, or reading like ads on the sides of anything. And I think that that's what civic a lot of like civic spaces do for us. They make things, they're the great equalizer, because we all experience it in the same way, no matter who we are or what walk of life it is. These streets, the city is ours, and so when we get to see the buildings display the voices of the people that inhabit the city, it's empowering in such a way. And I'm thinking of teenager Jessica. If I would have had the opportunity to participate in something like this, or even know that something like this is possible for someone like me, it would have radicalized my whole world, because I would have been like, poetry can exist in so many other places other than just paper. And I'm really excited to be a part of something that is sending that message to so many other folks that never even expected to be able to contribute something. So I think that that's really beautiful, and to see it happening, it's so exciting.
I mean, Layla, to hear that, to hear that seeing had younger Jessica seen this, it could have radicalized her whole world. I mean, what does that tell you about like the import of these words, and in particular that they're love letters? I'm sort of curious why you chose that as a frame.
I'm one of those aspirational readers where I buy lots of books and they kind of like read a few pages and they sit. There's this book of love poems between Rilke and, sorry, I can't remember the other two poets' names. They're Russian and hard to pronounce, and I don't want to make a fool of myself. But that love letters are also about heartbreak. They're also about longing. They're about desire. They're about all of the things. And I'm quoting Victoria Chang, another one of the poets in this project. When I spoke with her one-on-one, she's like, writing is also about writing about the things that are next to a thing. There are many things next to love. And also just that we know that love is the thing that moves us forward, so. But and I think I love what Jessica said. It also makes me think that there the other component of this project is that there's an open call, and I really it was important for me to pay people and put them on the same level as co-authors with these writers. Of course, the range of quality is all over, but they have the real lived experience as well of the last year in a collective way. And so I got a poem this morning from an 11-year-old. There are over 1,000 submissions as of last night, and open call closes today. So I think the accessibility of the project really is a foundational element of it.
And what is going to happen to these submissions after the exhibition ends?
Well, it's kind of like a Snapchat. It's here today, gone tomorrow, literally. But I should also say what an immense place of privilege it is to have five compelling writers send 50 like mini love letters, and to receive them all at the same time. It's a spiritual experience. It's a beautiful act, and it would be wonderful to make it available as a book. It's a snapshot in time, I think, of our city emerging.
Yeah, in 15 words or less.
You want me to say it in 15 words or less?
No, that you're asking people to do that in 15 words or less. I mean, I don't know, Jerry or Jessica, like, how do you distill? How do you distill a love letter into 15 words or less?
Well, I think, I mean, for me, short poems are my favorite, because I feel that they get, it's the easiest way to just share it with somebody. And for, like, again, we keep using the word accessible, but I think it's really important that, and it's rare when something calls itself accessible, and it actually is, right? Because this is for anybody with any level of reading, any level of attention span. It's just a phrase, and then you could walk around with that with you all day. Like, how many times don't we have, like, the one song lyric stuck in our head, and we don't even know the rest of the song, but I'm like, I know there's one line of the hook or whatever. And that's what we did. We just gave everybody a hook to walk around with and to be able to fish within themselves whatever love they needed, it they need to, like, bring out to the surface. And I think that that's, like, so beautiful, and I love it. And it's a really fun challenge too.
I really think that 15 word, any format like that, is great, because it just forces you to push all the superficial crap out of the way. It forces you to be precise and specific with your choices. And it forces you essentially to distill something and to get something down to its essence in a very effective way. There's a friend of mine, is a poet, Jeff McDaniels, and he wrote a poem about having being allowed to have a certain amount of words per day, like 60 or 70 words. And he would, you know, want to fight with people in the store, but he wouldn't, because he wanted to hold on to his words for his lover that night. And he would call her and she'd hear nothing but silence, and she would know he still loved her, but he used up all of his words. And I thought a lot of Jeffrey McDaniel's poem in doing this, because I think there's in some way too much verbiage in the world that we live in, and it's become part of a schema of abuse and anger and hatred all too often. And when the words are chosen, not as though they're a free, limitless amount, but that each one and each syllable is critically important, then what you're constructing is something fundamentally different, more concentrated, and in a way, much more authentic.
Jerry Quickly, Jessica Salgado, Leila Hamidi. The project is Love Letters in Light, which is on view through the month of May. You can learn more about the project at lovelettersinlight.la. Thanks to you all.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Stephen.
And now for Tough Questions, where we put the hard questions about free expression and free speech this week to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. And I should say, we're actually in person now, unmasked, both vaccinated, for the first time ever for Tough Questions. So, hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen. This is exciting.
I know, in person. So let's go right in. So, Suzanne, this week we were out with a new analysis showing that anti-protest bills are cropping up in state legislatures nationwide at a pretty alarming rate. And it feels like it's not a coincidence that this crackdown is happening, you know, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the subsequent rise in protest movements. What do you make of this whole trend?
Look, we documented this for the first time in our report, Arresting Dissent, that came out back in May of 2020, within a couple of weeks of the murder of George Floyd and the emergence of the protest movement. And so we felt it was a very timely contribution to sort of point out the ways in which state legislatures all over the country had taken steps to narrow and constrict protest rights. And it was a trend that grew out of a whole series of protest movements kind of rolling over the last 3 or 4 years, beginning with the Women's March and then the airport protests against the Muslim ban, pipeline protests, to protect the environment. And so all of that sort of a social justice assembly and mass mobilization that we saw during the Trump years sort of triggered this potent backlash and a real effort to put limits on people's right to assembly and to demand that, insist that people stay away from critical infrastructure in states. And, you know, that's sort of an obvious way of preventing people from doing these pipeline protests, enhancing penalties for individuals at protests that get the least bit disruptive, you know, even if the individual had no hand in a turn toward rowdiness, you know, restricting people's ability to protest on highways, you know, even legitimizing in some cases, you know, if protesters are knocked over or run down, that there wouldn't be penalties. So a really disturbing set of moves aimed to claw back our First Amendment right to freedom of assembly. It's one of the five freedoms, of course, you know, called out by name in the First Amendment. And so all that happened, and then the murder of George Floyd happened, and you saw this kind of unprecedented outpouring during, you know, the pandemic last spring and summer, people out on the streets and a lot of overly aggressive policing and many altercations, protesters being treated harshly. We documented and did a great deal of advocacy concerning infringements on press freedom rights in the course of those protests. And so, you know, really not a surprise that in the wake of that, this trend has only intensified. And we document in this report more than 100 proposals introduced since June of 2020. So over, you know, in less than a year, and really in the period since the George Floyd protests for Black Lives Matter took place, all over the country, and a kind of a kitchen sink trend, if you will, where many of the newer proposals include kind of everything that has come up in terms of different ways of curtailing these rights. And so, you know, as we look at this backlash against democracy, efforts to restrict voting rights across the country and to prevent people from having their say, you know, this assault on protest rights is a critical piece of it. And to the extent that Republicans sort of hold the mantle of being the party of free speech and the First Amendment, this really exposes that just as an out-and-out lie.
So, Suzanne, meantime this week, we sent a letter to President Biden asking him to ensure that human rights are at the forefront as the U.S. restarts nuclear negotiations with Iran. We know Iran is a jailer of writers, of intellectuals, a regime that's punished those who dare to speak out. How might the Biden administration influence that in the months ahead as they start to reengage with Iran?
Look, I think it's extremely important that as we reengage and try to resurrect the Iran deal, the JCPOA, after the Trump administration turned its back on it, that human rights be part of the equation. And it was a concern, frankly, back in 2015 when the nuclear deal was first negotiated, that human rights became something of a sideline. You know, although it's also true that before that, the Obama administration had championed the reestablishment of the UN special rapporteurship on Iran. And so, you know, there were some steps that the Obama team took to try to ensure that human rights was part and parcel of our Iran policy. And I would say that that sort of waned over the years. And this letter, bringing together a number of groups, really lays down an important marker to say, look, this matters to us, you know, this administration, which, you know, we applaud that their rhetoric on human rights issues has been very strong. And it's clear that President Biden and Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, you know, they're all people with reputations, you know, who really care about human rights and the U.S.'s role as a standard bearer and the importance of values to the U.S.'s influence around the world, the idea that, you know, trying to restore U.S. moral authority is actually integral to our national security and global influence. And so, you know, Iran is an important proving ground for that. And, you know, we don't insist that it necessarily be part of the nuclear negotiation itself. You know, that may not be the way to go about it, but we do want kind of a concrete, visible, forceful, an outspoken U.S. voice on human rights issues. We've seen the, you know, not just the trends that you mentioned in terms of repression of dissent internally. You know, we have many cases, particularly Nazreen Sotoudeh, a just absolutely courageous, fearless writer and human rights lawyer who we've championed for a long time as she has been in and out of prison for her activities and her self-expression. But even beyond that, we've seen in recent years Iran reaching outside of its own borders to intimidate Iranian citizens who have fled to freedom abroad and even in this country. And so some really alarming trends, and the U.S. needs to push back. It needs to make clear this is, you know, even if the nuclear deal comes back together, you know, this is not a warm embrace. There are human rights sanctions that have been imposed on Iranian officials who are responsible for some of the most egregious abuses. Those need to remain in place as long as the abuses continue.
Now, well, just briefly to turn back to the U.S. for a moment, we saw a rare bipartisan grouping on Capitol Hill come together behind a bill called the Future of Local News Act that was introduced this week. We've been supportive of Congress taking this kind of act, in particular setting up a committee that would examine the issue of the collapse of local journalism and perhaps propose some real reforms to reinvigorate local news. Do you think that's actually doable?
You know, I do, and we've been more than supportive. I mean, I we were really the catalyst for this. Our report, Losing the News, back in 2019, sort of laid down a powerful case about the threat that is posed to democracy when local news dries up and disappears. And it's a really bracing account of the news deserts that are cropping up all across the country, individual case studies of how democratic accountability and citizen engagement and civic life are undermined when the credible news outlets disappear. So one of our central recommendations is that we need to re-examine public funding for news. And we recommended the creation of a congressional commission back in 2019. We didn't expect progress during the Trump administration. We didn't get that progress. But what we did get actually is sort of a sea change in attitudes on Capitol Hill. And I think part of it was the pandemic, which was just such a incredibly local story, where whether it was, you know, when you were looking for PPE or you needed to know, you know, which hospitals were at capacity or where you could get tested or what the rules were, you know, even today, you know, where we still have mask mandates in place or not. It's a very much a local story. And so for us, we've been, you know, for many, many months making the case on Capitol Hill about the importance of taking dramatic steps to shore up local news. And look, we as a free expression organization, when we went into this research on this topic, we were very hesitant to suggest that government really should have a larger role here. You know, we would prefer to keep government out of the news. And yet, if you look at the scale of the problem, a $30 billion hole, maybe a billion dollars of which has been filled up by philanthropy and some, you know, really wonderful initiatives by foundations and individuals to help address the problem. It's just not a solution that can get to scale. There are innovative business models that are being developed, but that too, you know, while some of them are promising, it's just kind of nowhere near a match to the scope of the problem. So we're thrilled to see this legislation introduced. And, you know, our next step, of course, is to ensure that it gets passed.
Right. Well, Suzanne Nassel is CEO of PEN America. She's also author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A short programming note before we go. Next week is the Penn World Voices Festival of International Literature, our annual global celebration of the written word. Normally IRL, this year we're staying mostly virtual. That means tickets are available worldwide. You can see the amazing lineup on our website, penn.org/festival. As a special bonus, the Penn Pod will be broadcasting daily next week, bringing you interviews with authors, highlights from the week, and some special surprises. Those episodes will pop into your feed if you're subscribed, and of course, if you're not, please subscribe and rate us. You can listen to all our episodes at penn.org. Follow us at Penn America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Penn America. This is the Penn Pod. See you Monday for the festival.